Act 4 Chapter 26 Side by side, the fourth teens were laid to an uneasy sleep in the morgue, right next to the adults who had failed so terminally to look after them. Somebody had... How? It was a mystery. Taken the cooling body from Gideon's arms. Who had plucked those spears from those terrible holes and carried Jean-Marie back? And a lot of people had spoken a lot of words to her, none of which had pierced her short-term memory. Teacher was there, in her mind's eye, praying over the broken sieve of Isaac Tetterus, and Herohark was in there somewhere too, and Palamedes, tweezering a big fragment of something out of the cooling corpse of Jean-Marie the Fourth. These images were as jumbled up and lacking in context as a dream. She remembered one thing, Herohark saying, "You dullard, you imbecile, you fool," all the old contempt of the Ninth House nursery back and fresh as though she were there again. Hero the architect sweeping down the halls of Dreaber, Hero the nemesis flanked by Crux. It wasn't clear what in particular Hero was haranguing her for, but whatever the reason, she deserved it. Gideon had tuned out all the rest of the necromancer's tirade, her head in her hands, and then Herohark had balled up her fists, breathed hard once through her nose, and gone away. The only thing that had made sense was that she had ended up in the whitewashed room where they were keeping Dulcinea, sitting alone in an armchair, and there she had gritted tears out of her eyes for an hour. Someone had washed out all her cuts with reeking vermilion tarry stuff, and it smelled bad and hurt like hell whenever an errant drip of salt water touched the wounds. This made her feel sorry for herself, and feeling sorry for herself made her eyes even wetter. Dulcinea Septimus was a good person to do this in front of. She did not say, "You'll be fine," as Dulcinea lacked the lung capacity to spend on platitudes. She just sat propped up on about 15 pillows and kept her thin, hot hand on Gideon's palm. She waited until Gideon had stopped her hard blinking, and then she said, "There was nothing you could have done." "Bullshit, there wasn't anything I could have done," said Gideon. "I've thought of everything I should have done. There's about 50 things I could have done and didn't." Dulcinea gave her a crooked smile. She looked terrible. It was a few hours before morning, and the early light was grey on her biscuit-coloured curls and blanched skin. The fine green veins at her throat and wrist seemed terribly prominent, like most of her epidermis had sloughed off already. When she breathed, it sounded like custard sloshing around an air conditioner. There was high colour in her cheeks, but it had the hectic brilliance of hot slag. "Oh, could've, should've," she said. "You can could have and should have yourself back into last week, back into the womb. I could have kept Pro by my side, or I should have gone with him. I can go back and make things happen perfectly if I just think about what I should have or could have done. But I didn't. You didn't. That's the way it is." "I can't bear it," said Gideon honestly. "It's just such crap." "Life is a tragedy," said Dulcinea, "left behind by those who pass away, not able to change anything at all. It's the total lack of control. Once somebody dies, their spirit's free forever, even if we snatch it or try to stop it or use the energy it creates. Oh, I know, sometimes they come back, or we can call them, in the manner of the fifth. But even that exception to the rule shows their mastery of us. They only come when we beg. Once someone dies, we can't grasp at them anymore, thank God. Except for one person, and he's very far from here, I think. Gideon, don't be sorry for the dead. I think death must be an absolute triumph." Gideon could not get behind this. Jean-Marie had died like a dog while Gideon napped, and Isaac had been made into a big teenage colander. She wanted to be sorry for them forever. But before she could say anything to this effect, A great cough that filled up about 2.5 handkerchiefs tore at Dulcinea. The contents of these handkerchiefs made Gideon envy the dead, let alone Dulcinea. "We'll find your cav," she said, trying to sound steady and failing so completely she set a record. "I just want to know what happened," said Dulcinea drearily. "That's always the worst of it, not knowing what happened." Gideon didn't know whether she could get behind this either. She would have been devoutly grateful to live not knowing exactly the things that had happened in vivid red and purple wobbling intensity. Then again, her mind kept flaying itself over Magnus and Abigail down there in the dark alone, over the when and the how, over whether Magnus had watched his wife be murdered like Jean-Marie had watched Isaac. She thought, it is stupid for a cavalier to watch their necromancer die. Gideon felt hot and empty and eager to fight. She said, without real hope, "If you want your keys back from Silas Octokizeron, I'll deck him for you." The coughing turned into a bubbling laugh. "Don't," said Dulcinea. "I gave them up freely by my own will. What would I want with them now?" Gideon asked baldly, "Why were you trying to do this whole thing in the first place?"
"Do you mean, even though I'm dying?"
Dulcinea gave a friable smile, but one with a dimple in it.
"That's not a complete barrier. The seventh house thinks my condition is an asset. They even wanted me to get married and keep the genes going. Me! My genes couldn't be worse, in case they produced poetry down the line."
"I don't understand." The woman in front of her shifted, raising her hand to brush a few fawn-coloured strands away from her forehead. She didn't answer for a while. Then she said,
"When you don't have it too badly, when you can live to maybe 50 years, when your body's dying from the inside out, when your blood cells are eating you alive the whole time, it makes for such a necromancer, Gideon the Ninth, a walking thanergy generator. If they could figure out some way to stop you when you're mostly cancer and just a little bit woman, they would. But they can't. They say my house loves beauty. They did, and they do. And there's a kind of beauty in dying beautifully, in wasting away, half alive, half dead, within the very queenhood of your power." The wind whistled, thin and lonely against the window. Dulcinea struggled to raise herself up on her elbows before Gideon could stop her, and she demanded, "Do I look like I'm at the queenhood of my power?"
This would have made anyone sweat.
If you lie, I'll mummify you."
"You look like a bucket of ass." Dulcinea eased herself back down, giggling fretfully.
"Gideon," she said, "I told your necromancer I didn't want to die, and it's true. But I've been dying for what feels like 10,000 years. I more didn't want to die alone. I didn't want them to put me out of sight. It's a horrible thing to fall out of sight. The seventh would have me sealed in a beautiful tomb and not talked about me again. I wouldn't give them the satisfaction, so I came here when the Emperor asked me, because I wanted to, even though I knew I came here to die." Gideon said, "But I don't want you to die," and realised a second afterward that she had said it aloud. The first finger and thumb of the hand ringed around hers. The dark blue eyes were luminous, too luminous. Their lustre was wet and hot and bright, and Gideon pressed those fingers between her hands very carefully. It felt as though even a little bit of pressure would crush Dulcinea to dust between her palms, like the very oldest bones kept in the ninth house os. Her heart felt sore and tender. Her brain felt sore and dry. "I don't plan on it, you know," said Dulcinea,
though her voice was thinning out now, like water poured into milk. She closed her eyes with a gravelly sigh.
I'll probably live forever, worse luck. Whatever happened to one flesh, one end?
I've seen those words before, said Gideon, thoughtless of where she had seen them. What do they mean? The blue eyes cracked open.
They're not familiar.
Should they be?
Well, said Dulcinea calmly, you would have said them to your reverend daughter the day you pledged yourself in the service of her cavalier, and she would have said them to you. But you never did that, did you? You weren't trained in the traditions of the House of the Locked Tomb, and you're nothing like a Ninth House nun. And you fight like... I don't know. I'm not even certain you were raised in the Ninth House.
Gideon let her head rest against the bedframe momentarily. When she had thought about this moment, she had expected to feel panic. There was no more panic left in the box. She just felt tired. Rumbled, she said. I'm sick of pretending, so yeah. Right on nearly all those counts. You know I'm the fakest-ass cavalier who ever faked. The actual cav had chronic hypothyroid and was a serial limp dick. I've been faking my way through his duties for less than 2 months. I'm a pretend cavalier. I could not be worse at it. The smile she got in return had no dimples. It was strangely tender, as Dulcinea was always strangely tender with her, as though they had always shared some delicious secret.
You're wrong there, she said. If you want to know what I think that you're a cavalier worthy of a lictor. I want to see that, what you'd become. I wonder if the Reverend Daughter even knows what she has in you.
They looked at each other, and Gideon knew that she was holding that chemical blue gaze too long. Dulcinea's hand was hot on hers. Now the old panic of confession seemed to rise up. Her adrenaline was getting a second wind from deep down in her gut. And in that convenient moment, the door opened. Palamedes Sextus walked in with his big black bag of weird shit, adjusted his glasses, and stared 2 seconds too long at their hand's proximity. There was something dreadfully tactful and remote and un-Palamedes-y as he said, I came to check in on the both of you. Bad time. Only in that I am officially out, said Gideon, snatching her hand away. Everyone was mad at her, which was great, albeit they could not possibly be as mad as she was. She stood and rolled her neck until all the joints popped and crackled anxiously, was relieved to find her rapier still on her hip, and squared up to Palamedes feeling terrifically dusty and guilty. I'm going back to my quarters. No, I'm fine, quit it. Thanks for the ointment. It smells bewitchingly like piss. For God's sake, Ninth, said Palamedes impatiently. Sit back down. You need to rest. Cast your mind back to previous rests I have enjoyed. Yeah. Nah. It's not even ointment, it's drawing salve. Be reminded that Cam pulled 20 bone splinters out of you and said there were still a dozen left. Nona Jesimus can get them out, or maybe not, added Gideon, a bit wildly. Might as well leave them in until I'm through getting people bumped off, am I right? Ninth. She indulged herself in storming out past the warden of the sixth and in careering down the hallway like a bomb. It was about the least dignified way to leave a perfectly normal conversation, but it was also really satisfying, and it got her out of there in record time. Gideon staggered down the hallway, picking orange goo out of her fingernails, and it was in this scratchy frame of mind that she nearly knocked down Silas Octokizeron in his floaty, bactericidal Eighth House whites. Column the Eighth flanked him automatically, looking more like jaundice than ever in the same colour. They are dead, then, his uncle said, by way of hello. The only thing that saved Gideon from howling like an animal was the relief that, finally, she would get the chance to shove one of Octokizeron's feet so deep into his ass he'd be gargling with his calcaneus. "They had names, you lily-livered, tooth-coloured asshole," she said. "And if you want to make a thing about it, I warn you that I'm in the kind of mood that can only be alleviated by walloping you." Colm blinked. His necromancer did not.
"I had heard that you were speaking now," he said. "It seems a pity. Save your gaucherie for someone else, Gideon Nerve. I've no interest in the frightened rantings of a Ninth House thrall."
"What did you call me?"
"Thrall," said Silas. "Serf. Servant."
"I don't want a bunch of synonyms, you smarmy cloud-looking motherfucker," said Gideon. "You said Gideon Nerve."
"Villain,"
continued the necromancer of the House of the Eighth, warming to his thesaurus. Colm was staring at Gideon, almost cross-eyed with disbelief.
"Foundling, I am not insulting you. I am naming you for what you are, the replacement for Ortus Nigernad, himself a poor representative of a fetid house of betrayers and mystics."
Gideon's brain skidded to a halt. It went back again to Dreaber, sitting with a fat lip and wicked friction burns on her wrists. The cries of the dwindling faithful, green lights in the powdery dark, the greasy smell of incense. A woman weeping, someone stealing her getaway shuttle, 1,000,000 years ago. 2 someones, one sad, one sadder, immigrants to the Ninth House themselves.
"She still has family back on the Eighth."
"You've been listening to Sister Glorica," she said slowly.
"I talked to Glorica on her return to the Mother House," said Silas. "And now I'd like to talk to you."
"Me? The thrall? The servant? The other 5 words you said?"
"Yes," said the boy, "because you grew up servant to a murderer in a tribe of murderers. You are, more than anything, a victim of the Ninth House."
That stopped the tiny bone in Gideon's soul snapping. That stopped her from striding forward and balling both hands in the exquisite linen and chill mail of his robes. That and the fact that she hadn't been straight-up shield-bashed yet by Colm the Eighth and wasn't in a hurry to experience this exciting time. She stepped forward. Silas did not step away, but he turned his head a little from her, as though she were a bad breath. He had very brown eyes, startlingly framed by thick, whitish lashes. "Don't pretend like you know what happened to me there," she said. "Glorica never remembered I was alive, didn't care about me when she remembered, and she wouldn't have said anything to you on the subject. You don't know anything about me, and you don't know anything about the House of the Ninth."
"You are wrong on both points," said Silas, to somewhere over her shoulder.
"Prove it."
"You are invited to come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht."
She scrubbed both her dirty fists into her eyes and narrowly avoided gumming one up with the terrible orangey salve, which was so noxious that it apparently caused splinters to leap from her body rather than hang around near it. Her corneas misted up momentarily with the smell. "Sorry, didn't hear you right," she said, "because I thought you said, come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht, the dumbest thing to say ever."
"You are invited to come and take tea with myself and Brother Asht," Silas repeated, with the kind of hard patience that indicated a mantra going on inside his pallid head. "You will not bring the daughter of the locked tomb, but you'll bring yourself, and you will be ready to listen. No price. No hidden motive, just an invitation to become more than what you are now."
"Which is," Silas said,
"the tool of your oppressors, the lock on your own collar." She couldn't handle any more, having already lived a long night and suffered a number of emotional torments, among them supernatural murder and petty interpersonal drama. Gideon shrugged her cloak over her shoulders, thrust her free hand into a pocket, and stalked down the corridor away from any uncles and nephews. The necromancer's voice drifted down after her. "Will you come and listen to what I have to say? Be decisive."
"Eat me, milkman," said Gideon, and staggered around the corner. She heard Colum's, "Means yes, probably,"
but not the murmured reply. From that time on, Gideon could not outfight the nightmares. She willed her subconscious to sink into a pattern of random eye movement that did not involve her waking up in a lather of cold sweat, but like so many things in her life now, it had lost fitness and apt response. She was dumb before the body of her failures, unmanned by the barrage of her brain. Gideon only had to close her eyes to see her own personal, randomly selected shit show. Magnus Quinn, still drinking his grassy morning tea, stabbed until his chest was steaming chunks of meat because she could not make her tongue yell, "Look behind you!" A steaming cauldron, filled with fragrant grain and the silent fetal corpse of Abigail Pent, sinking beneath the surface before Gideon's blistering fingers could dig her clear. Isaac Tetteris, gulping and swallowing from an upturned jug of acid that she was unable to wrench from his febrile, trembling hands. Jean-Marie Chateur, whose dismembered arms and legs kept turning up while Gideon made a bed that got stickier and wetter and more jumbled with bits of Jean-Marie as the covers were turned, and the old dream of her mother, alive now, overlapping with her life in a way she hadn't in reality, shrieking, "Gideon! Gideon! Gideon!" While, as Gideon watched, crones of the ninth gently levered her skull from the rest of her head with a big, crunchy crack. And Hero, telling her to wake up. That had only happened the once. The ninth necromancer sitting in the dark, wrapped in a mouldering duvet like a cloak, her face very naked and blank and shorn of its monochrome skull mural. Gideon had fallen back into an uneasy sleep almost immediately. She could never decide if she had dreamed that into being. Herohark was not exploding, or having her intestines dripped out of her ears like streamers, or sloughing off her skin right down to her subcutaneous fat. But she had been looking at Gideon with a coal-eyed expression of absolute pity. There had been something very weary and soft about the way that Hero Nonagesimus had looked at her then, something that would have been understanding had it not been so tired and cynical. "It's just me," she'd said impatiently. "Go back to sleep." All signs pointed toward hallucination. At that, Gideon had to sleep, because the consequences of waking were too hideous. But from then on she slept wearing her rapier, her gauntlet on her chest like a heavy obsidian heart.